Hi, this is Catherine, just dropping in to say hi and to tell you that both Kate and I have newsletters. My newsletter is called Highbrow, Lowbrow, Mediumbrow, and hers is called The Bowerbird. Both are on Substack. We'll put links on the First Time Instagram feed and on our website, and we would love if you would subscribe. Thank you.
Happy summertime, First Time listeners, or happy wintry new year to our listeners in the Northern Hemisphere. My name is Kate Mildenhall, and my co-host here at the First Time podcast, Catherine Collette, and I are both at the beach. Maybe some of you are too, but we wanted to give you some ear happiness over our break. So we've put together our top 10 episodes ever for you to revisit and get you inspired for a new year of writing and reading and creativity. Welcome to our summer series. Happy summer and happy listening. The First Time podcast records on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and future. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. To start our summer series, we are taking you back to our first ever episode in 2018, where Catherine and I discussed why we embarked on this First Time podcast adventure and then spoke to the writer Claire G. Coleman. Claire G. Coleman is a Noongar woman whose family belonged to the south coast of Western Australia. She writes fiction, essays, poetry and art criticism while either living in Naarm, Melbourne or on the road. Born in Wajak Noongar Budja, Perth, away from her ancestral country, she has lived most of her life in Victoria and most of that in and around Naarm, Melbourne. During an extended circuit of the continent, she wrote a novel influenced by certain experiences gained on the road. She won the Black and White Indigenous Writing Fellowship for that novel, Terra Nullius. Terra Nullius was published in Australia by Hachette and in North America by Small Beer Press. It was shortlisted for numerous awards, including the Stella Prize 2018, the ABM Matt Rochelle Award for New Writers 2018, the Aurealis Award for a Science Fiction Novel in 2017, and was also highly commended in the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards in 2017. Since we first spoke to Claire, she has been incredibly busy. Her second novel, The Old Lie, was written in response to what she learned when travelling and was published in 2019 by Hachette. Lies, Damned Lies, Claire's first non-fiction book, unpacking the effects of the history of Australia's colonisation, was released in 2021. In 2022, Claire's third novel, Enclave, was published.
Welcome to the first episode of the First Time podcast. Catherine, what are we doing here?
Kate, my first book, The Helpline, comes out with Text Publishing in September this year. At the moment, as you know, it's nearing the end of June, so it's about a little over two and a bit months away. But probably for the past 12 months, pretty much since I signed with Text, I have been asking you, my published author friend, what to expect.
Loads of questions.
And I guess it occurred to both of us that the thing of it is there is no one universal experience. Everyone has a very, very different experience. So over the next 17 episodes, we are going to follow me from now to the point of publication and beyond.
Into that great unknown.
So it's a kind of reality show meets writer's masterclass. We're also asking other Australian authors, editors and agents about their first times so I can pick all of their brains.
And share their wisdom with all of our listeners. Before we get to where things are with you right this moment, Catherine, let's talk a little bit about how you got here. How did The Helpline go from being an idea to a book on the shelf?
Okay, so I work as an engineer. I work planning and designing sewers. Not a very glamorous job.
It's totally glamorous.
But for a brief period of time, I worked at a council in more of a community development sort of a role. And in that role, I sat next to a woman who worked with senior citizens clubs. One day she said, you know, you've got to come out and meet the president of the local senior citizens club. And I said, great. So we went out and met this woman who I've always really, really struggled to describe until Donald Trump was elected. And essentially she is like a version of Donald Trump. And I mean that in all seriousness.
I haven't heard you say it that way before.
I actually mean that in all seriousness. She was just, I think David Gillespie has written a book on psychopaths, and she probably would meet all of the criteria for a psychopath, as indeed does Gillespie suggest Donald Trump does. So I met her. She sort of was really ruling this senior citizens club with an iron fist, and the council essentially orchestrated a coup to get rid of her. And I just always loved that idea of a coup happening in a senior citizens club.
Hot material.
So I wrote a short story, and the short story became the basis of the novel, and the novel ended up being the helpline.
But the novel didn't go from short story to text publishing.
No, that's true. So what helped me, the real turning point for me was the hard copy program run by the ACT Writers Centre. That's where I not only met my agent, Jacinta DeMarze, but also my now editor, Mandy Brett, from Text. So that was a real jumping off point, I suppose, for me. I signed with Jacinta not long after hard copy finished, and then went through the process of submitting the manuscript to multiple publishers, having a few offers and deciding who to go with, and, of course, going with the wonderful Mandy.
It's incredibly exciting.
It is really exciting, but now this is the pointy end of things, I suppose.
So
before we get onto that, can we just talk a little bit about your novel Skylarking? Because you had a very different experience to me. So how did Skylarking come about?
So Skylarking came about in a very strange and serendipitous way. And as we'll discuss at various times, I've told this story many times and people may have heard it. I went back to study writing, which I've always wanted to do, went on a camping trip, camped next to a grave, found the story that would become the story of Skylarking, which is a story of a young woman dead before her time and her best friend on an isolated lighthouse in the 1880s. I, like you, started with a short story that I was writing as part of a fiction class at RMIT, very quickly became too unwieldy for a short story. And when I had about 50,000 words, the pragmatic person that I am decided that obviously I was now writing a novel because one couldn't spend all this time on something that wasn't going to do anything. And very fortunately for me, I pitched it before it was finished to Aviva Tuffield and she signed it. And
unfinished.
Then I finished it and then it was published in 2016. Now, this is the first episode of the podcast, Catherine. Where are things for you right now?
Okay, so edits are done. I had a mammoth.
Yay.
I had a very different to the norm kind of editing process, which we'll talk about in another episode. But edits are done. The book goes to print next week, which is very exciting. I have just received my first review. We'll save that for another episode.
She looks happy, okay? Just for the listeners, she's laughing. There's no weeping here.
International rights have sold in the UK and North America. There has been some interest from film scouts.
Huge.
Coming out of America. I'm doing the Brisbane Writers Festival close to when the book comes out, an event in Geelong, and a booksellers conference in about a month's time.
So much.
So it's all happening.
Juicy material for us to get stuck into. And we need to say this, and this is kind of a disclaimer for you, Catherine. This is a really risky enterprise for you, bearing your soul through what is going to be a kind of tumultuous time. For you, there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of expectations from yourself and from the people around you about how this book is going to go. And you have committed to speaking to me about this and sharing it with lots of people. So I want to ask you a couple of questions now, knowing that come November, we're going to come back and we're going to ask these questions again. We're going to just pull apart your brain and emotions
live
out loud. What are you excited about right now?
I think it's fortuitous this podcast is called The First Time because I kind of am excited about it all. I think you only get the first time once. So, you know, embrace it and, you know, the frame is excitement. Yeah, there's nervousness there, but mostly I'm excited just to experience it. I do think birth is a good analogy.
It's a great analogy.
You know, sometimes people find that problematic, but, you know, yeah, I'm excited about all of it. It's a ride. You know you're alive. I think that's
you are
going to
know you're
me.
Alive. Is there anything that you're not excited or you're terrified about?
We do have an episode planned for this podcast that involves me talking to a psychologist for writers, Alison Manning.
Look at what we do for you guys. Look at what we are doing.
If I was seeing her privately, I would probably find that exciting. But the fact that I'll be doing that on air feels a little bit more daunting. Yeah, so that's a bit nerve-wracking. I guess, you know, the pragmatic side of myself is I like writing. That is something that excites me, but particularly around the book coming out, a lot of my time will be doing more promotions and publicity and those sorts of things, which are exciting, but are also, I can already see, are energy intensive.
They really are.
So that the fact that they take me away from writing is just, you know, makes them a little bit less appealing on some level.
So we're going to be sitting here in November having this conversation again. What is life going to look like for you then?
I think life will be, I should have thought of an answer to this, shouldn't I?
It's live. Come on.
I think I've been really lucky because some of the international rights deals have sold. I have been able to carve out a bit of writing time. So I hope that where I am come November is that the book has gone really well and that I'm, you know, happy about its reception in the world. But I also really hope that I'm immersed in a new project. I really want to be grounded in that. As much as, you know, all the book is exciting and I am excited about all of those things, at the end of the day, I kind of want to come back to doing it again, like working through that process again, because there's a lot of satisfaction in that.
There most certainly is.
Without wishing it away. I don't want to wish it away. I want to have ridden the ride and be, you know, enjoying the next phase.
Wise words, an excellent prediction, and we look forward to seeing if all your hopes and dreams come true. In this episode, we speak to Claire G. Coleman about writing from her caravan, having to be on a signing table with Garth Nix, and how to keep yourself open to luck. Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming author Claire G. Coleman to The First Time. Claire, thank you so much. I know you've been very busy, so it's a great pleasure to have you here.
I have been busy and it hasn't stopped. It's been going on for months and months and months and months.
And it just keeps getting busier, I imagine, with all of these shortlists, etc.
Well, yeah, this 2 weeks that we're in the middle of now is probably among the busiest with radio and stuff like that. It's just, it's all come out of nowhere.
And certainly not out of nowhere. It's an incredible book.
Thank you.
And has quite rightly got all of these accolades. I wanted to start, Claire, can you share with us the story of how Terra Nullius came to be?
Well, I was travelling around Australia in my dodgy as hell old caravan, towing it behind an even dodgier old car. And I went to my ancestral country and went to the little museum there, took my dad, went to the museum, and there we found a large section of the museum dedicated to my family story, which neither my dad nor I knew was there, and got talking to the Historical Society staff who staffed the museum, who told us there was a massacre memorial being built and having an opening ceremony in 2 weeks' time. We couldn't stay in the area, so we left and came back. Well, I left and came back. And when I was there, I was at the memorial opening and the story just came to me all of a sudden. And I drove up the coast of WA, up the west coast,
yeah,
heading north, and wrote the story as I headed north and across the top. And then came down to Alice Springs, kept writing it, probably finished it by Alice Springs, edited it on the way back to Melbourne, and then sent off to the Black and White Indigenous Writing Fellowship competition, and then started driving up the east coast. And when I was on the east coast heading north, I found out I'd won.
That is an extraordinary story and so incredible. I've got to get some details of, as you're travelling,
mm-hmm,
how are you carving out time in the day to write? Are you sitting in the passenger seat? Like, how are you doing it?
Well, it was discovered that I am most alert at five to seven in the morning.
Nice.
It's too early to travel between 5 and 7 in the morning.
Yeah.
So I get up then and write. And when I was travelling, I'd get up and write from 5 to 7, have breakfast, travel however many kilometres, doing like 2-3 hours drive. Set up camp, maybe write some more, but then certainly the next morning you'll get up at 5 a.m. and work 5 to 7.
And Claire, before the story kind of came to you at that memorial, had you already had a writing practice where you were doing that daily? Like, have you always been a writer?
No, I'd wanted to be a writer. I'd written poetry and I'd done some casual writing. I'd done a bit here and there, but I never really was serious about it until that story happened. And then when the story happened, I had to write it, so... It's one of those things, had a choice, I write the story down or I go completely mad.
Yeah, wow. Better choice to get it down. Mm. So when you were, you said you got to Alice and then you started editing. So just a really fluid kind of motion for you writing, yeah, the whole thing. Did you have other people reading for you at this stage or was it still just you were keeping it really close?
At that stage, I was still keeping it to myself. A bit later, my girlfriend read it, but for most of it, I just kept it to myself.
Okay. And so how did you get up the courage to submit it to the Black and White Fellowship?
Oh, I didn't have courage.
Okay.
I did it anyway. Right. I actually have said so in a panel that when I was in a little keynote I did it in Brisbane, that I didn't have confidence. I was shaking with fear of rejection when I dropped it in the letterbox. I was terrified, but I did it anyway because I felt that the story had to be, at least had to make the attempt to publish it. So I did it. It was a horrible feeling.
And then you find out that you've won this fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
What did the fellowship give you practically and emotionally?
Well, emotionally, it gave me validation that I could actually do this, and it kind of told me that the story would come out and be published one day, because the prize involved a cash prize, fairly substantial cash prize, editing help from Indigenous editing interns at the State Library of Queensland, and when the editing process is completed with the assistance of these editors, a publishing deal at the end.
Fantastic.
So once I won that prize, not only did I feel like, wow, I'm actually okay at this, but I also knew it would eventually be published.
And how long was that period then of you editing and working on it with those editors?
Well, it wasn't particularly long. I started editing with them in, I think it was April. And if I remember rightly, I signed the contract that year. So wow. It couldn't have been very long.
It's not very long at all. And I mean, writers are often talking about the fact that they do this for 10 years and they get rejection after rejection. So it's an extraordinary kind of tale for you.
I always tell other writers they're quite welcome to hate me for it. I believe that there's three parts to being an artist of any sort. There's talent, there's hard work, and the third one everyone forgets, there's luck.
Yeah.
If you're missing one of those, you're not going to make it. If you're missing the luck, you're not going to make it. But if the lucky chance comes and you're not ready for your lucky chance, you're not going to make it either.
Yeah. You were obviously really ready for it.
I was.
Was the publishing deal with Hachette?
Yes, it was.
Did you? Okay, so you already knew those. And did they, when you kind of first started speaking to them, were they just completely on board with the story?
Well, they were, because as part of the deal for the Black and White Fellowship project, an acquisition editor, a publisher from Hachette, is involved in the selection process for the winning manuscript. So they knew the manuscript before I won.
Yeah, okay.
So they were there.
So they were already. And I must admit, I noted in your acknowledgements that you said about Robert Watkins that sometimes he believed in you more than you believed
in
yourself.
Yeah.
Was that really important, the people you chose to have, that you had around you and that you chose to have around you?
Oh, that's fundamentally important. I don't think people think of writing as a solitary task, and it is to a degree, because when you're writing your first draft, it's completely solitary. But as soon as you move from writing to publishing your work, it becomes a major group effort. There's so many people involved in getting a manuscript to print on a piece of paper. I know people do self-publish, but I don't know how someone could self-publish in print, because I could not tolerate doing all that work myself.
Yes. Claire, were there other people in the Black and White Fellowship at the same time, or is there only one? Did you have
a
community?
Two winners every year. And that's a strange story as well, because when I went to the ceremony for the prize, the other winner was a cousin I didn't know.
Oh, wow.
So, that was weird.
Okay, that is weird. And so were you able to, you know, workshop with each other, or did you have any kind of support from each other
We gave each other support by email, because she lives in South Australia and I was travelling. So,
yeah.
But the main support I got was actually the Black and White editing trainees who were interns, who were very, very excited to be working on my manuscript. So,
how did you find, people often say that edit can be really hard, and it's really hard to look at what people are saying about your work and seeing it in other eyes. How did you find the experience of being
editing? I found editing very hard emotionally, because they find all the little bits that aren't perfect and all the rough edges. So you look at your edits when they come, and you cry and cry and cry. But then you knuckle down, do the edits, and then it's exhilarating, because you read the book after the edits and it's always better. Well, in my case it was anyway. The edits for Terra Nullius took it from being what I thought was a good book to a great book. So it's scary than exhilarating.
Yeah.
I think to me now, having done it once, the edit is the biggest, most exciting part of the process.
Yes. And you're doing this, as you said, while you're still travelling.
Yes.
You're doing the editing. Did you have that practical thing of, like, how do you keep the whole story in your head? Did you have it print out? Do you do it all on laptop?
Well, when I wrote Terra Nullius, I did not have a good laptop.
Yeah, okay.
I wrote it on an iPad.
Wow.
With
the whole first draft.
iPad, Bluetooth keyboard.
Wow.
And then when I won the prize money, I bought a cheap-ass laptop and a 12-volt charger so I could plug it in to my caravan's power. And then, I just edited on that. I didn't have printouts because it would have been too cluttering.
Yeah.
I don't like them anyway.
And do you find you're obviously, I hope, writing again now, right? Working on another project.
Well, yes, I am because I signed a 2-book contract. So,
brilliant.
My second novel's been delivered. It's in edit now.
Oh my goodness.
And my third novel is in progress at my end. I haven't written it yet.
So you obviously didn't already have that second novel.
No.
So you've written that during this intense period of promotional work and festivals and all the rest of it.
Yeah, mostly, or partially. I started it as soon as my edits for Terra Nullius finished. There was about, I don't know, between the end of the edit and the start of publicity, it was a couple of months. I started it during that time.
Okay.
So I could get a foundation before...
Things went mad. And did you find that process, I'm so interested in the way that you were travelling while you were writing, does that mean that you are more able to pick up your laptop anywhere and when you're at a festival or you're travelling for the work doing promo as well?
No, well, actually, I haven't done it yet, okay. Writing or doing promotion. Because when I was writing or travelling, in a way, the caravan's like a little cone of silence.
Yeah.
I've got this little capsule that's the same every morning, so I had this safe little world. So I find that easier. I haven't yet tried to write while on planes or in airports, stuff like that. I've done edits in airports.
Yeah.
I've got last-minute copy edits, final edits.
Yeah.
While I was on the way to a writer's festival.
Okay.
So I had to edit them on my iPad because I didn't have my laptop with me.
they do make things difficult.
They do. I said if there's going to be any final edits, I wasn't going to do them.
You were done. Claire, what have been the highlights of publication for you?
Well, I think it was probably first seeing my book in print. That's always exciting. I mean, even when the proof copy comes,
yeah,
that's fantastic. And then the final copy is in the shops. I never get tired of looking at it in shops.
No, and it's such an extraordinary looking book. Did the bound proof have the cover that it has now?
It had a black and white version of it. It's a beautiful book, absolutely.
It's beautiful.
And the other exciting thing is meeting other authors at writers' festivals and doing panels because I love doing that. So I think it's great fun.
And had you been to writers' festivals before? Like, was that part of your world before?
No.
Or was it a whole new world?
Completely new. I'd never been to a writers' festival. Never met another writer. I met some performance poets back in the old days. I used to do performance poetry
a
bit back, 15 years ago. But
so what was your first festival?
Melbourne.
And how did you find, what did it feel like?
Well, Melbourne was completely out there. It was out there insane, completely insane. Because here I was, I arrived at a writers' festival. I was in Melbourne anyway. I arrived to the Writers' Festival on the first day I went there. It was the first time I'd seen my book on a shelf.
Oh, wow.
Because they got early copies in. They got like some boxes shipped early to Melbourne to put them on the shelves for the Writers' Festival at the festival bookshop. And then I went into my first ever thing as an author was a really intense panel.
Okay.
So it was completely and utterly insane.
And do you find that that has got easier each time? You're not saying that it was necessarily hard that time, but has it got less intense each time?
Well, as far as intense is concerned, really being dumped into a really intense, heavy panel on your first day as a professional author, really, at Melbourne Writers' Festival. After that, everything seems like a walk in the park.
Yeah, right.
I go to Writers' Festivals now and people say, are you going to prepare? And I'm like, nah. I'm just going to turn up.
That's great.
Because I've already done the hardest thing you could do.
What weren't you prepared for? What were the things that shocked you or were difficult?
I still am never prepared for the occasional random fan personing I get. It doesn't happen often, but every now and then somebody will recognise me in a bookshop in the street and get all excited and I just...
Ask for your autograph.
Yeah, and I don't really get it, I suppose.
You're not owning your literary celebrity yet.
No, I'm not. It's true, I'm not. That's pretty difficult at times. And I still find, although I love it, the practice of signing books at the signing table at festivals feels a bit strange, but I have to get used to it.
Yes. Yeah, I can imagine you would have some long lines too.
Actually, my first ever signing line, I was sitting there and I was next to Garth Nix. And my book was unknown.
That's completely unfair.
I know. So I was just watching this enormous line and I had no one.
That's hard.
That's harsh.
That's hard. And I think I love that thing of writers' festivals where you also get to share that experience with other people when they say, oh, yeah, I was next to whoever for my first time and you learn that.
Actually, I think I had Garth Nix on one side and Samantha Shannon on the other side.
Okay. You didn't stand a chance.
No.
Claire, I wanted to ask you a little bit on author intent, because I think this is really interesting. And I heard you on an interview with the Book Podcast, and you were asked what you wanted readers to take away from your novel. And you said you'd like Terra Nullius to provoke people to understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know then the experience of having readers read your book. What has that been like? Do you feel like you've hit the mark that you wanted to?
I remember saying, I've said to several people before my book was actually in print, I said that if I'm told by one person that my book has changed the way they think and feel about the Aboriginal people of Australia. I said that if one person tells me their attitude has changed, then I know that I've achieved my mission and I can kind of feel happy in myself. Well, from what I've heard, it hasn't been one person, it's been thousands of people have had their attitude changed. So that's intensely gratifying. I achieved what I wanted to, I set out to do when I wrote the book. I had a mission and I achieved it. So that's good, I suppose.
I think that's an extraordinary thing. And it's a, I imagine for readers being able to share that with you as well, that that's a gratifying thing for them to be able to do with you as well.
Well, yeah, some readers find it. I've had readers a bit shy to tell me what they think of my book, and I've had other people excited to finally get to speak to me about it and about what my intent was and about they're having feels about the book, and they had to tell me about their feelings, which is fine. I mean, I love that.
How do you correspond with, is this people getting in touch with you on social media or coming up to you at festivals?
Coming up to me at festivals and events, public appearances, it happens a bit.
Do you find it exhausting as well, Claire?
Well, I find the public stuff exhausting anyway. I find interviews exhausting. I find festivals exhausting. The first few festivals, I had tons of adrenaline, so I was like going to see everything. And first few I did. But now, after a panel and then a signing, I tend to go to the green room or back to my hotel room and fall over.
Yeah.
I think that's because I want to give to anyone who's come to a panel. I mean, I want to give them the best experience they can. I give a lot of myself because I want people to feel like I care, because I do care and I want to convey that to people. So I do find it very tiring.
Yeah, it's a big gig.
It is.
Claire, Terra Nullius has been shortlisted for numerous awards before and since its publication. So obviously the Black and White program, it's also been shortlisted for the Aurealis Awards, the Stella Prize, the Matt Rochelle Prize at the ABIAs. Long-listed for Indie Book of the Year for a debut writer, highly commended for the Victorian Premier's Award, winner of the Tin Duck Award, and you were also runner-up for the Mud Literary Award.
So and runner-up for the Ditmar Award.
And runner-up for the Ditmar
and Award. And I'm a finalist in the Noah K. Hemming Award.
Wow. Okay.
That's a new one.
they're new ones. So it's a huge list.
Yes.
It's really big for a debut.
Mm-hmm.
How have you found the experience each time you've heard about a new shortlisting?
Oh, that's a hard question. There's a bit of, I do get frustrated sometimes because I feel like always a bridesmaid because I've been shortlisted for so many things. But every time I get listed for an award, it's exciting, it's scary, it's intimidating, especially when I see the other people on the list. It's quite intimidating. Awards, it's a great boost to the self-esteem being listed for an award, I suppose. Yeah.
So validating. Have you found, do you see immediate new Twitter followers? Do you know if there's an increase in sales in the books? Is it having that impact as well?
Well, there's an upkick in sales every time I'm listed for another
award. For all of them?
Pretty much all of them.
Fantastic.
Some are bigger than others, like the Stella Prize. As soon as you're shortlisted for Stella,
it's huge.
Sales just go berserk. It's crazy.
That's fantastic. And for such a new award, it's an extraordinary impact that the Stella's having.
Yes, it is. I was in Adelaide for the Adelaide Writers Festival when they announced the shortlist for the Stella Prize. And I wandered into a bookshop just after it, a bookshop where I knew the staff there. And I saw the staff I knew running around frantically trying to make sure they had copies of all six shortlisted books. Because they knew that within an hour they'd sell out.
They were all going to sell out.
Trying to collect them all and make sure they quickly get an idea of how many they had of each book, because they knew that they're going to sell like mad.
That's extraordinary. You've been to kind of all of the big festivals this year and at the end of last year. Were those invites already there, or do you think that had to do with the shortlistings as well?
Well, most of them, I think they're already there. Some of them, I imagine, are because I'm not too bad at public speaking. So
pretty good.
I tend to, after doing an event, I get more offers from after I do one. Yeah, those festival organisers, they do talk.
Yes, they do talk.
They do talk. But I think most of them came before most of the listings.
Okay. Do you feel like there's a time that you will say, okay, I'm not doing festivals for the next 6 months or 12 months, I'm going to focus on the writing? Or do you think that now it's part of the gig for you?
Part of the gig. It's good for the sales. You do get a bit of an honorarium for going to the festivals. I think the festivals are useful. I know that there's a big kick in sales every time I go to festivals. So, and it is part of the job, I think. Mm. I would like to take some time off festivals, but I don't know when that's going to happen.
I was going to say, it doesn't look like it's happening anytime soon.
But I am going away up north anyway.
Okay.
I've actually turned down one festival because I'm going on holiday.
Okay,
so
great.
I have done it.
Excellent. Just said no. Claire, have you got advice to other writers about navigating those feelings about, you know, getting on the shortlist, always being the bridesmaid? Like, you know, how do you think they impact on writers' psyches in general?
I think a lot of writers go through so much emotional rollercoaster, such an emotional rollercoaster every time they're listed for an award and then not knowing if they're going to get it. They look at the award and go, oh my God, there's no way I'm going to beat person A.
Yep.
Or, oh my God, everyone on that list is better than me. I'm screwed, which is the thought everyone has. I think the best way to navigate those feelings is to just know that everyone is having that feeling.
Yeah.
If you think you're alone, if you think you're the only person who's in a blind panic about an awards listing, then you're going to feel like this. It's a horrible thing. But I'll tell you what, I've made friends in the last 9 months. I've made some friends in the literary scene. And we are constantly joking about, oh my God, I got listed for this thing. I'm never going to make it. And they'll go, yeah, well, I've been listed with you too, and I'm not going to make it either. So it must be you. Jokes. It's ongoing. And also, winning an award is lovely, but it isn't pivotal.
Well,
the most important thing is having your book in print.
Yeah, oh, it certainly is. That's lovely talking about that relationship you've got with the other writers as well. Mm. How has your the community around you, the writing community around you, shifted since publication, and how does it support you?
Well, I didn't have a writing community before publication. I didn't know any writers. For a start, being able to hang out with other authors at the festivals it's like, I keep telling people this joke. Every evening at the festival is like Friday night drinks for people who work normal jobs. Yeah. They see their workmates all week, and then on Friday night they go out and get drunk. Well, authors see their friends, their work friends, at festivals only, because most of us only see each other at festivals because we're scattered all across the country. And it is good to know people. And also there's a lot of support over social media and a lot of email support. And if you're feeling a bit cranky, generally someone will make a joke to try and cheer you up. And also, if you've got social media friends, even just social media friends among other authors, if you've got something to promote, generally everyone will help each other out.
Yeah.
They'll promote each other. All of us will promote each other, even against each other sometimes.
Yeah, par for the course. Do you feel like there's any awards, you know, the Stellar Award obviously came out of what people saw as a big gap. Do you think that there's any awards that are missing in Australia? Is there anything that you want to see?
It'd be nice to see some more Indigenous writing awards. There are some, but it'd be nice to see some more of them. It'd be nice to see more awards for young writers, to encourage young writers. There are some prizes for young writers, but it'd be nice to see some more of them.
Yep. I think, you know, what you're talking about, those ideas that both fellowships and time and money and introductions, all of those things being part of it really help.
Certainly unpublished manuscript fellowships, I think they're the greatest invention anyone's ever thought of to help out a writer, because even things like the Matt Richell Award.
Yes.
Winning that one gives someone a big boost.
Yep.
And there's others by other publishers. I can't even think of them right now.
There seem to be more at the moment as well.
Publishers don't. And I think the reason publishers do it is because firstly, it encourages writers who might otherwise be too nervous to send their work in. And the other thing is, it really does give a big boost to a publisher's slush pile to look
at. Yes. It really does. I don't know how they deal with them. Claire, you said, I was reading an interview with you on the Hachette website, and you said Terra Nullius went well, it was the best thing you've ever done. And now you want more, not more success, that's secondary, but there are more stories that you want to tell.
Yes.
How do you put aside those feelings that are associated with success to get back to the writing?
I personally believe that writers who focus on success rather than writing for its own sake or for the sake of the story generally are not going to have the success. I think if you write trying to work out what's going to sell well, it won't. The writers who do well are writers who just love stories. The writers who succeed are just ones who love stories. And I think for me personally, having a voice and having my stories out there is more important to me on a personal level than money by a long shot. And I think that's the right attitude to have as a writer anyway, because there's not much money in writing generally. So it's got to be about the love of the art itself. And not just the love of getting your story, but also the love of the craft of writing. A writer has to love writing or they're never going to write.
Yes. Good advice. I wanted to ask you quickly a little bit about genre, because I know that Terra Nullius has been listed as all kinds of things.
Yes.
Literary, speculative fiction, apocalyptic fiction. Do you put a label on it or do you prefer not to?
I originally, when I was writing it, imagined it purely as dystopic and apocalyptic. And the reason is because the history of Australia is dystopic and apocalyptic. So I just thought of in those terms, all these labels that they've been put on it, they're an attempt for people to shelve a book that doesn't shelve easily, essentially. Everybody who looks at it or reads it sees it on a different shelf. And that's fine. But I personally believe it's time to have bookshops to have just books.
Yeah.
I have a section, fiction. Not have fiction, literary fiction, women's fiction, men's fiction, sci-fi.
Yeah.
Just fiction.
Has it helped or hindered? I'm not going to ask you to tell us what you're writing next because I know writers don't like to talk about it, but has it helped or hindered what you're writing next? What you think people are expecting of you, perhaps?
Being hard to classify has kind of helped because if the audience don't know what to expect, the publishers can't say your audience would be angry that it's not like your other work. So in a way, having something that's more difficult to classify is perfect because they'll just
do whatever you want next. Well, I, for one, am very excited to see what you do next. Claire, I'm wondering if you can recommend a debut book to us, an old one, a new one, something you're reading.
I've been trying to think about this. Do you know what's the most incredible debut book ever, I think? The Hobbit was a debut.
Yes.
If you think about The Hobbit as a debut, that's just extraordinary.
And terrifying for the rest of it.
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, he spent 30 years world building, but still, it's a ridiculously powerful debut. And Frankenstein.
Yes.
Is Frankenstein or is it not the greatest debut novel of all time?
Yes. Wow. We shall put it to the listeners. That makes me think too, because obviously Tolkien was a huge influence on you. I've heard you speak about that. And do you continue to read Lord of the Rings regularly? Are you one of those people?
I was one of those people.
Yeah.
But I've got less time on my hands these days, so I haven't read it for a couple of years. But yes, I was one of those people. Actually, if I wanted my Lord of the Rings fix, the movie is almost as satisfying. So just watching the movie on a semi-regular basis helps.
And gives
too.
Your eyes a break for all the other reading that you're doing at the moment. Claire, can I ask, Catherine is obviously about to publish her first book. First time about to embark on this journey. Do you have any advice to give her about navigating this part, getting through it?
Get some sleep. fall on the goodwill of other authors. If you're tired, other authors will make you feel better. And if you've got a decent publicity department at your publisher, listen to what they're saying and do what you're told, I suppose. And don't be afraid to ask anyone for help. You ask your publisher, your editor, your publicist, just ask people for help. Releasing a book is not a solo effort, and that's what people forget.
That's fantastic advice. Claire, I've so enjoyed chatting to you. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
Giving your time.
It's been fun.
Thank you. So Claire G. Coleman, and we've got you up for our first time quick five. For your first time, were you agented or unagented?
Unagented.
Remain so?
Remain, yes.
Advance or no advance?
Advance.
Overseas territories or just Australia, New Zealand?
Overseas.
Festival invites or no festival
Lots.
Invites? And do you keep an eye on your sales? Do you know how many copies you've sold?
I don't know how many copies I've sold, but I do occasionally ask my publisher to tell me.
Excellent. Okay. Claire G. Coleman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you like what you hear, please share the love on socials at The First Time Pod, on Insta and Twitter, or by leaving a review wherever you listen. To support our work in season 6, you can become a patron via patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast, or check out our work and upcoming events and workshops on katemildenhall.com or katherinecollette.com. We'll be back with brand new episodes in March 2023.